I'm Eugene Meyer, and I want to welcome you to our 9th annual Rosenkranz debate. And I want to express our gratitude to the Rosenkranz Foundation for supporting this event. We love having this Saturday centerpiece for our conversation, an intellectually sharp one-on-one debate between two hugely, highly prominent legal theorists. This series had a wonderful start in 2008 with a discussion between Judges Richard Posner and Mike McConnell, then Judges Guido Calabresi and Frank Easterbrook in 2009, in 2010, Richard Epstein and William Eskridge. In 2011, Paul Clement and Larry Tribe debated health care. In 2012, we had Judge Kaczynski and Professor Hadley Arkus. 2013, Randy Barnett and J. Harvey Wilkinson. In 2014, Michael Mukasey debated Nadine Strossen. And last year, Professors Robbie George and John McGinnis debated, quote, the Constitution was made for a moral and religious people and is indeed suited for the government of no other. To moderate this year's debate, I want to introduce Judge Jennifer Elrod, who serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, who's a longtime friend of the Society, going all the way back to her days at Harvard Law School as a law student there. Judge Elrod?
Today's topic is resolved. Hostile environment law on and off campus often violates the First Amendment. As you might expect, Professor Volokh will be taking the affirmative. Professor Volokh teaches free speech law, tort law, religious freedoms law, church-state relations law, and a First Amendment amicus brief clinic at UCLA School of Law, where he also has taught copyright law, criminal law, and a seminar on firearms regulation. Before coming to UCLA, he clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and for Judge Alex Kaczynski on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. He is the author of the textbooks, The First Amendment and Related Statutes, The Religion Clauses and Related Statutes, and Academic Legal Writing, as well as over 75 law review articles. He's a member of the ALI, but many of us know him best from the Volokh Conspiracy, a weblog that gets about 35 to 40,000 page views per weekday. We are very pleased to have Professor Volokh here with us today. Thank you. We are also pleased to have Professor Deborah L. Rohde with us today. She is the Ernest W. McFarland Professor of Law, the Director of the Center on the Legal Profession, and the Director of the Program in Law and Social Entrepreneurship at Stanford University. She was the founding president of the International Association of Legal Ethics. She's the former president of the Association of American Law Schools, the former chair of the American Bar Association's Commission on Women in the Profession, the former founding director of Stanford's Center on Ethics, the former director of Stanford's Institute for Research on Women and Gender, and a former trustee of Yale University. She worked as counsel to the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee during the impeachment proceedings against William Clinton. She is the nation's most frequently cited scholar on legal ethics. She is the author of 27 books in the fields of professional responsibility, leadership, gender, law, and public policy. And she has received the American Bar Association's Pro Bono Publico Award for her work on expanding public service opportunities. But most important for today's debate, you may be interested to know, Professor Volokh, that you have your work cut out for you. She was also the first female president of the Debate Society at Yale. At this time, Professor Volokh, you may begin.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, as always. It's a great pleasure to talk about the subject. Partly because it's a subject I find very interesting, partly because it's a subject I've been working on for literally 25 years. This is the subject matter of my student note, so I know there's some law students I've seen in the hallways. I presume they're here in the audience. Work hard on your student notes. They could come in handy. They could totally come in handy. So I'm going to be talking about freedom of speech and hostile environment harassment law. Now, what is hostile environment harassment law? It's implemented in various ways. Some of it is law in the sense of something that could lead to legal liability. To some extent, the federal government has been imposing it under Title IX, requiring universities to restrict speech that creates a hostile environment. Also, universities, including public universities who are bound by the First Amendment, sometimes try to implement the rules of hostile environment harassment law into their own internal law, into the speech codes that they impose on their students. So speech is harassment. If it is severe or pervasive enough to create a hostile, abusive, or offensive environment in work, in education, in public accommodation, in housing, perhaps even in other zones as well, based on race, race, religion, sex, national origin, age, disability, military membership or veteran status, and depending on the jurisdiction, sexual orientation, marital status, citizenship status, political affiliation in DC, for example. Political affiliation is covered for the plaintiff and for a reasonable person. This goes far beyond some of the things that we generally think of, like unwanted touching, unprotected speech, like threats or fighting words. Those, I think, actually, there is not much of a First Amendment problem, certainly none with unwanted touching. Or speech said to a particular unwilling listener, what I call sometimes one-to-one speech, speech to a person. I think, actually, there are good constitutional arguments for allowing restrictions of speech said to a particular unwilling listener, but hostile environment harassment law is not limited to that. Now, what does it cover, though? I mean, if we're going to talk about the First Amendment and hostile environment harassment law, we'd have to have a sense of what it is that's being restricted. And this, which I think is a pretty accurate formulation of the rule, doesn't really tell us that much, right? What is severe or pervasive enough to create a hostile, abusive, or offensive environment based on these things for a plaintiff and for a reasonable person? Well, the most we can do is look at the case law. You could also look at how universities have been applying this, but I'm actually going to focus on things that we found from decisions of courts and of administrative agencies. Although if you look at university speech codes and their application, you'll see even more of this. So here's speech that's been found to have helped create hostile environments. Sometimes it's not the whole thing. Often it's not the whole thing. But as we'll see shortly, any speech that is used as part of a hostile environment claim ends up being deterred by hostile environment harassment law. Sexually themed humor. And not just humor at a particular person's expense, or humor that is foisted on a particular unwanted, unwilling listener, but just humor that some people find offensive because it's sexually themed. Misogynistic rap music played in a workplace. That's from a particular court case. Sex-based job titles. There are a couple of decisions which say calling particular job foreman or draftsman is something that could lead to a possible harassment claim. Music videos depicting an array of sexually provocative conduct. That too could lead to liability, which is to say government-imposed punishment based on the content of speech. Bible verses on paychecks or biblical statements in speech to employees, if they are found to be severe or pervasive enough, whatever exactly that might mean. And in these cases, they were so found. Anti-veteran speech could qualify as well. That's from a particular federal agency decision from some years ago. Statements by an NYPD counterterrorism advisor arguing that Islam is evil and Muslims are security risks circulated in emails and to the mailing list of people who are talking about in NYPD about terrorism risks. Allegedly racist imagery displayed in bars. There's a case about that in Boston where a bar was held liable for creating a hostile public accommodations environment for displaying imagery that was perceived, perhaps correctly, to be racist. A suggestion that Trayvon Martin shooting wouldn't have led to the same controversy if a white man had been shot. That too could lead to hostile environment harassment claims. Display of Confederate flags. The EEOC has specifically said that even just by itself, with nothing else, occasional display of Confederate flags on people's clothing, like t-shirts, could be hostile environment harassment. There's a case in California where writers of Friends, for Friends, were making lots of sexually themed jokes and comments. That led to a claim that this created a hostile environment based on sex for a writer's assistant who was offended by hearing all of these jokes. Ultimately, the California Supreme Court rejected that claim. One of the justices actually stressed the First Amendment argument, although the majority rejected it by actually reading California harassment law considerably more narrowly than federal law has been read. Patrons at Minneapolis Library were viewing porn. Now, it's an interesting question whether libraries ought to be free to impose filters on such viewing. It seems likely that they can, because they can say, look, you know, we're providing access to the internet. We don't have to provide access to all of the internet. But that wasn't the issue, because the library wanted to take a maximally speech protective view. But some librarians complained that because they would glimpse porn on the screens of people who were accessing it, that created a sexually hostile environment for them. The EEOC sued, or at least threatened to sue on their behalf, and ultimately got a six-figure settlement from the library, which of course also led the library to be legally required to impose filters. And that's for sexually hostile environment. You can imagine similar things for racially or religiously hostile environment. Teacher using sexually themed language in a lecture, that could lead to liability. Journalists expressing sexually, religiously, or racially offensive views in a newspaper or magazine office. There's a case involving the New York Post where that was part of what the court said may ultimately lead to liability. This is one case that came up recently in the news. This is the Gadsden flag, the Don't Tread on Me flag. There was a complaint brought before the EEOC that this flag was racially harassing because Gadsden was a slave owner. EEOC rejected that, I think, quite rightly. But also because some racists had used the flag, not in this workplace, but in public discourse, like kind of in the news. There'd been some stories about racists using these flags as a racist symbol. The EEOC, rather than just rejecting the claim, which it often does with regard to harassment claims if it finds there's really no basis, said, well, it's all very contextual and it all depends, and the complainant should be free to show that in context this might have been perceived as having a racial message to it. Nor is this just an accident. This is a quote from Judge Keith in the Sixth Circuit in an early harassment law case, where he says, harassment law requires employers to prevent bigots from expressing their opinions in ways that offends their coworkers. By informing people the expression of racist or sexist attitudes in public is unacceptable, people may eventually learn that such views are undesirable in private as well. Thus, Title VII may advance the goal of eliminating biases in our society. Now, I might agree or disagree with him on that, but it does seem pretty clear that this was understood quite deliberately as a means of suppressing certain kinds of viewpoints on the grounds that they abuse or offend or are undesirable. Now, what effect does this law have? And I should stress, by the way, these claims are not easy to win. Certainly, if you are a plaintiff and you have one of these cases, plaintiff's lawyer coming in the, you have one of these cases coming in the door, don't expect an easy victory, although you might be able to settle in the shadow of the law on this. But the law has a much broader effect, broader chilling effect here than just the actual ultimate jury verdicts, which often don't happen because, as we know, many cases are settled before they reach a jury. One thing we know is that vagueness, and I do think that that it's fair to say that tests such as severe or pervasive enough to create an offensive environment based on religion, let's say, is pretty vague, lead people to steer far wider of the unlawful zone. They chill, and in fact, they're often designed to chill. We can also, I think you can imagine courts interpreting these rules in a very narrow way that's limited only to certain very extreme stuff. But there's no particular reason to think that courts would necessarily do that. And both of these quotes, by the way, are from Justice Brennan, I think, are quite wise. If there's an internal tension between prohibition and protection in a statute, we can't assume that ambiguities will be resolved in favor of adequate protection of free speech rights. One way of thinking about it is, imagine a client comes to you and asks for your advice. Says, look, an employee, a student, a patron is complaining about offensive speech by employees, students, or patrons. I can restrict the speech. I mean, surely private entities aren't bound by the First Amendment. They could restrict the speech if they want to. But he says, I don't want to. I'd rather not suppress the speech. But I really want to avoid liability. I really want to avoid the government using its coercive power to hold me liable for the speech. What should I do to be safe? And this speech could be harsh condemnation of Catholicism or of Islam, jokes about the latest political sex scandal, sexually suggestive art print hanging in someone's office, allegedly racist political statements, comments referring to veterans as baby killers. Could be in a factory, in a newspaper, at a university, in a bar, in a bookstore. The one thing you can't tell him is, oh, well, tell your employees that you can't say anything that, when aggregated with the speech of other employees, would be severe or pervasive enough to create an offensive work environment for a reasonable person, right? That's not going to work. That's not going to work at all. Severity or pervasiveness requirement is of little help. What you must do is you must prevent each individual statement in order to prevent the aggregate. So you must ban any kind of speech that, if repeated, may constitute harassment. And if you look at what experts recommend, that's exactly what they say. And these are people who don't have any First Amendment axe to grind. Say, because the legal boundaries are so poorly marked, the best course of action is avoid all sexually offensive conduct in the workplace. That had to do with sexual harassment, but it certainly covers speech within the rubric of conduct. It would apply just as much to racially, religiously, and such offensive material. I have lots of other examples, but not lots more time. But if you look, pardon? Exactly.
You have 1 minute.
Exactly. You look at injunctions, by the way, they also likewise restrict individual statements based on her viewpoint. So this is harassment law suppressing speech. It's suppressing speech through the government's power as sovereign. To be sure, it's limited to workplaces, except when we're talking about educational harassment. No, that's colleges, public accommodation, that's restaurants. But even if it's limited to workplaces, that's where most people spend a third of their waking hours. And what's more, every place is someone's workplace. Libraries, art colleges, government buildings, restaurants, all of them are this way. And then, of course, as I said, also universities are subject both to hostile work environment law, because speech there might offend employees, and hostile educational environment law and campus speech codes made in the shadow of that law, because speech might offend classmates. Hostile public accommodation environment law applies it to bars and restaurants and other places. What's the result? The government is suppressing speech that offends based on various subjects, said by a wide range of people, including political speech, religious speech, art, social commentary, in factories, offices, as I said, pretty much any place, including newspapers, universities, and the like. It's a content-based, viewpoint-based restriction on protected speech. It's not limited to unprotected categories such as threats and fighting words. It's imposed by the government as sovereign, and it's thus, I think, presumptively unconstitutional. And in fact, I think that presumption cannot be rebutted as to the speech I'm talking about, which is protected speech that's not just said to a particular unwilling listener, but is overheard or is maybe on a t-shirt or something along those lines. So when applied to protected speech, I think this poses very serious First Amendment problems, whether in the world workplace, universities, online, public accommodations, or elsewhere.
Thank you. Professor Rodin?
It's a great honor and pleasure to be here today to discuss this critical issue. One of the things I admire most about the Federalist Society is its commitment to diverse views. And at this historical moment, there's a particularly great need for those of differing perspectives to really listen to each other and to look for common ground. This debate is no exception, and I am your diverse view. The last time I was at a debate of this size was at the Association of American Law Schools, and I was debating, or supposed to debate, Alan Dershowitz on some adversary system question. And at the very last minute, he had to pull out, and it was too late to get anyone else. So I debated myself. And I must say, it was a very satisfying experience. There were two podiums, and I moved back and forth. And as you might imagine, I clearly won the debate. And I did have a thought as I got on the plane that perhaps if Eugene were to be unavoidably detained and unable to join us today, I might be able to recreate that experience. But alas, as you see, we are both here, and we do have some points of disagreement, although many points of agreement. But before I talk about the First Amendment questions that are at the core of the debate, I want to briefly put the issue in context. For centuries, women were harassed, but the law offered neither a label nor a remedy. When I was in college, we had no term for it, no complaint channels. We spoke of having a problem with your professor, and the problem was always yours, never his. All that, of course, changed in the 1980s after the Equal Employment Commission and the courts began recognizing sexual harassment as a form of prohibited sex discrimination. And what hasn't changed is the persistence of the problem. Estimates of the number of women who've experienced sexual harassment in the workplace range from 30 to 80%, depending on who you ask and how the term is defined. And despite several decades of Title VII law, those rates haven't much budged. What has changed is the frequency of formal complaints, which have doubled over the last decade. But these represent only a fraction of abuse. Victims report harassment in only 5 to 10% of cases, and less than 3% end up in litigation. Major barriers to reporting include guilt, shame, fears of retaliation, loss of privacy, an unwillingness to jeopardize working relationships, and doubts that an effective response to the complaint will be forthcoming, and that's a well-founded fear. On campus, surveys by groups including the Association of American Universities have found that about two-thirds of female undergraduates report experiencing sexual harassment. Only a fifth of college students have either not experienced or witnessed harassment on campus. Only 17% of those students reported the conduct, and a majority of college administrators believe that their current systems are inadequate to deal with the problem. Research on campus racial harassment finds that it's significantly related to lower achievement rates and higher dropout rates for students of color. Technological innovations have also created new opportunities for sexist and racist comments and widened their audience. The anonymity and ease of online harassment has broadened its scope. Between 20 to 40% of youths age 12 to 17 report experiencing some form of cyberbullying. And researchers estimate that 30 to 40% of internet users will face some form of cyber harassment. And most of those victims are, unsurprisingly, women. And they're also subject to distinctively gendered abuse, including pornographic images, threats of sexual violence, false rumors about promiscuity, and postings of their home addresses with a suggestion that they should be raped. There's also some reason to fear that the recent election has unleashed some vitriol that's going to exacerbate problems of hostile environments. The Southern Poverty Law Center and Chronicle of Higher Education have been tracking recent incidents of hateful harassment and intimidation. And they recount some shameful examples: swastikas, abusive graffiti, direct confrontations. Two gay men called fucking faggots. Black students sent racist messages, including photos of daily lynching calendar events. Muslim women wearing hijabs have been told they can't wear them anymore, have had them torn off, and have been spit upon and threatened with deportation. A Muslim high school teacher was left a note telling her that her headscarf wasn't allowed and suggested that she tie it around her neck and hang herself with it. I could go on and on, but you get the picture. So how well does hostile environment law address this problem? Where Eugene and I agree is that there are some truly terrible decisions out there. He cited many, ones that give insufficient weight to First Amendment values. Where we disagree, perhaps, is how often they occur, how often they are sustained, to borrow language from the resolution, and how to weigh free expression as against other values. How do we keep the First Amendment from shielding speech of harassers that silences the speech of the harassed? And that's what I want to focus on. First Amendment doctrine has always recognized other values in carving out exceptions to its coverage. That's particularly true with what the court has recognized as low-value speech that does little to advance public discourse and much to damage individual reputations and the quality of public life: libel, threats, obscenity. Much hostile environment conduct falls into this category. Now, on the 50th anniversary of Title VII, It's fair to say, as Eugene has eloquently, that anti-harassment law chills some abusive expression. But it also protects other workers' ability and students' ability to speak, work, and learn on equal terms. And for every case of overbroad restrictions of expression that he cites, I can cite to you examples of overly protective decisions. Let me start with the workplace. Title VII, as Eugene said, prohibits harassment that's sufficiently severe and pervasive to alter the terms of employment and create an abusive working environment. The Supreme Court sustained that standard in 1993 and should continue to do so. And true, there are overly restrictive decisions along the lines he mentioned, but the converse is also true. I'll give you a few examples. One, where a trial court ordered summary judgment against the plaintiff, whose claims included an incidents where a coworker dropped his pants and ordered her to suck my dick, you black bitch, and another posted Ku Klux Klan cards in her workspace. The court found this behavior offensive, humiliating, and threatening, but insufficiently severe and pervasive to alter the terms of her employment. Another case that the trial court found insufficiently egregious involved an employee who referred to women as whores, cunts, pussies, and said of the plaintiff that all she needed was a good lay. As I understand Eugene's position, hostile environment protections are a form of inappropriate content regulation. But, of course, the court has allowed content regulation in many contexts, barring sex-segregated advertisements, labor disputes, abortion protests, captive audiences. First Amendment absolutists, of course, argue that the captive audience exception should be limited to the home and that any expansion would open the door to regulation of speech in any number of public forums. And while I appreciate that concern, I would distinguish public situations where individuals can avert their eyes and workplace settings where their livelihoods depend on not doing so, and exposure undermines their willingness and capacity to perform effectively. And the same point can be made about hostile environment regulation in the campus context. The EEOC's guidance in this area provides that a school can violate Title IX if it knows or should have known about a hostile environment and fails to take prompt and effective corrective action. Schools, however, are only liable for deliberate indifference. And the Supreme Court has allowed educational institutions to ban speech that might substantially interfere with the work of the school or impinge on other students. And we know that racist and sexist speech can do that. We also know that courts have struck down campus harassment rules on First Amendment grounds. And indeed, pretty much every challenge to campus speech codes has found them violative of the First Amendment. But at the same time, we still have conduct that seriously undermines the educational experience of students. And I'll give one notorious example that cuts close to home because it involved law students. A posting of lewd and derisive statements about female Yale law students on AutoAdmit, a law school message board. Among the posts were claims that the women were universally hated, that one had engaged in a lesbian affair with a Yale administrator, had bribed her way into Yale Law School, had engaged in drug use and bashing gay people, and had warred around like a feral cat. Commentators Google bombed their postings so that they would show up first when the victims' names were searched. And in a world where 4/5 of surveyed employers report using search engines and social network sites to search for information about candidates, there are significant harms from those anonymous postings. One of those victims withdrew from law school, the others reported job consequences. The site owner refused to take down the offensive posts on First Amendment grounds, and when asked why they didn't keep identifying information about the posters, responded that, well, people would not have so much fun, frankly, if they had to worry about their employers pulling up names on them. Other commenters on the site maintained that the women had no right to ask for removal of the libelous and defamatory post because, as one put it, if these girls can't handle a little humor, how can they handle life? Similar examples and similar arguments have been made about hate speech on cyberspace. Danielle Citron opens her recent book on the subject with the story of a female graduate student whose blogs about her weight struggles began attracting anonymous posters. They identified her phone and address, included claims about her untreated sexual diseases, her racist rants, her losses of jobs for sexual misconduct, and financial irresponsibility. And 3/4 of the links appearing on the first page of a search of her name were cyber harassment. In another case, a tech blogger who spoke out about threats and defamation that she experienced online found that her speech increased the abuse. She finally shut down her blog after trolls posted ostensibly nude photos of her along with contact information and her supposed interest in sex for money. This kind of harassment doesn't advance discussions of public value. It shuts them down. Online vilification has significant consequences. It damages reputations, it prevents employment, encourages stalking, leads to serious mental health problems, and even suicide. The traditional response by First Amendment absolutists to abusive speech is more speech. Yet individuals who try and engage in this defense find that cyberbullies spam their accounts and saturate their blogs with doctored, obscene, and sexually violent pictures. Robust democratic discourse isn't possible if harassers drive victims from it. As Yale professor Owen Fiss once put it, in some contexts, we must lower the voices of some to permit the self-expression of others. Preventing harassers from driving people offline would advance the very reasons why we protect free speech in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have a response?
I do. But let me pull it up. Oh, so here I was writing it up, and now I've mislaid the slide. Here it is. Can we have the display? Great. I very much appreciate Professor Rohde's thoughts about this, and I think these are very important points that I think we are right to take seriously. And the fact is, it's true. I mean, I'm not a First Amendment absolutist because almost nobody is. There are some restrictions on speech that are permissible. The question is whether hostile environment harassment law is a sound way of dealing with the concerns that Professor Rohde talks about. And one way of thinking about it is to look at the examples that I think, some of which are quite powerful, that Professor Rohde pointed to, and see how they get filtered through various approaches, and whether hostile environment harassment law is the right way of dealing with them. So examples: online harassment, cyberbullying, online vilification. Now, some of it clearly punishable if it's threats, if it's libel. Threats and libel law ought to operate in this context, and they sometimes do, although, of course, those rules have their own limitations. But again, the question is it properly seen as a matter of something that should be judged under the standards of hostile environment harassment law? Posting of lewd and derisive statements on online discussion groups, that too, if it's libelous, there could be a libel lawsuit. There were libel lawsuits. But as I understood it, it wasn't just lewd and derisive false statements of fact, it was also lewd and derisive opinions. So the question is whether that is something that should be restrictable. Hate speech in cyberspace. Again, I don't think we're just talking here about calls to restrict libel, calls to restrict threats. It's calls to restrict hate speech, whatever exactly that might be. And again, not just in the workplace, but in cyberspace. Racist and sexist speech in universities. Again, I didn't hear any limitation to racist and sexist threats or fighting words. It was speech more broadly. Swastikas, abusive graffiti, threats, personal insults. Again, like abusive graffiti, you know, graffiti is a crime. Swastikas in some context may be criminally punishable if they're threats or if it's something that's drawn on somebody else's property. Sometimes they're protected speech. So again, I think if you look at it through traditional lenses of things like threats law, fighting words law, vandalism law and such, some of these things, the things that I think really clearly should be punished, can be punished. But as I understand it, the suggestion was that hostile environment harassment law was actually a good way of dealing with these things. So let's think about that. I mean, imagine that we do see hostile environment harassment law extended not just from workplace and education and such, but just to things like, in the auto-admit case, is just an online discussion group. There have been attempts to do that, by the way. There have been claims under public accommodations environment theory calling for that. Now, I think if I had brought this up some years ago and said, well, the consequence of people trying to impose hostile environment harassment law would be that there would be attempts to suppress online speech on these grounds, many people would have said, oh, that's not right. Obviously, hostile environment harassment law is limited to workplace and the like, but it seems like there are now calls to apply hostile environment concepts to this. So can I have the slide again? So yeah, again, imagine a situation where you could sue, I don't know, you could sue maybe service online service provider, maybe Google, for allowing access to pages that are severe or pervasive enough to create an offensive online environment. Can that really be constitutional, given all that the court has said about the need to protect speech against viewpoint-based restrictions, against vague restrictions? Can it be that, for example, again, if you're not limited to fighting words or one-to-one speech or to threats, then presumably it would be a web page that has swastikas, or a web page with swastikas that criticizes me. Would I be able to go some and say and sue that web page for creating an online environment, hostile online environment? It sounds like the call is for something along those lines, and that I think just shows the danger of that kind of rationale and the potential for that kind of rationale to demolish what we had thought were very well established First Amendment principles. Now, the courts, I think, have quite rightly acknowledged that there are serious First Amendment issues there. I hope they would be even quicker to acknowledge when it's divorced from the workplace and educational institutions and moves into places like online speech. But courts have acknowledged, this is from a Fifth Circuit opinion by Judge Edith Jones some years ago, that there are very serious First Amendment problems here. And I don't think that it's enough to for example, point out that there's a cap captive audience. Note, by the way, of course, with the online speech, we're going beyond any captive audience arguments. I think it just shows how easy it is to slip once one accepts these kinds of restrictions from the area where they're defended, say, as under captive audience rationale to other areas. But even if you do look at the captive audience rationale and when it comes to universities or workplaces, first of all, harassment law has no captivity requirement. Many cases do not involve kind of pervasive rants that a person cannot escape, or rants that happen every day. It's just incidents that happen every couple of weeks that you may not be able to avoid hearing them at first because you may not have any notice that they're coming, but that's really not much different from our experience outside. But if you compare that, you imagine picket lines where employees walking twice a day past picket signs that call them scabs or traitors, or people who have to work within sight of offensive billboards or other offensive signs, or a store clerk who must regularly serve customers wearing offensive t-shirts. These people are actually more captive than many students and many workers who have potential claims under hostile environment harassment law. So I think the captive audience rationale can't justify even the hostile work and educational and public accommodations environment rules that I was talking about. And most certainly, I think it cannot justify calls to broaden those even further to online speech, however offensive and disturbing that online speech might be. Let me just close, though, by turning to one thing that Professor Rohde mentioned, and I tried to foreshadow it, but I think she's absolutely right. There are lots of decisions that throw out these cases, some of them perhaps even incorrectly, but throw them out on the grounds that the speech is not severe or pervasive enough. And it's inevitable when you've got vague rules like severe or pervasive. It's hard to even say, well, one court is obviously misreading those. It's not clear that there's a lot of there to be misread. But if you look at it, again, put yourself in the position of a counselor, of a lawyer who's responding to a request for advice from a client who's an employer, educational institution, or place of public accommodation. And you've got two decisions, one which throws out a harassment claim, even based on a lot of offensive speech, and another that accepts and allows to go forward a harassment claim based only on a little bit of offensive speech and perhaps offensive political or religious speech. I don't think you tell your client, well, look, you know, chances are you'll get the first judge and not the second judge. Go right ahead. I think instead you'll say, look, you don't know what kind of judge you're going to get. You don't know eventually if there's a jury what kind of jury you're going to get. If you're asking me what to do to stay safe, my answer is to suppress any speech that might lead to liability. And in fact, as a practical matter, since most people don't want to win a case, they want to avoid having even to litigate a case, it's suppress any speech that might even lead to a lawsuit. And that's what I think those cases that I mentioned can't just be dismissed as outliers, partly because there are quite a few of them, but partly because each one of them casts a long shadow, because wise lawyers have to keep in mind that what happened once might easily happen again.
Your red light is on.
All right.
Eugene asks, is hostile environment law a good way to deal with this problem? To which my response is, compared to what? No, it's not a good way. It is vague. It does cast a chill over free expression. But would we really be better off in workplaces or campus environments that had no rules at all, a complete wild, wild west? We're seeing that now on the internet, and it's not a pretty picture. Eugene asks you to put yourself in the position of a lawyer advising a client, employer, or university about what to do to stay safe. Well, I'd like you to put yourself in the position of a lawyer advising somebody who's been cyberbullied, who asks, what can I do to stay safe? Would you tell that person, well, you can sue for libel or defamation if you can find out who these anonymous posters are, but it's going to cost you a lot of money, and it's unlikely you're going to find a lawyer willing to take the case on a pro bono basis. So what would you advise that client? Would you say, you know, I'd shut the blog down? You really want to be safe? That's the way to do it. And I think any responsible lawyer in this climate, at this historical moment, would have to give that advice. And that's something that those of us who care about the First Amendment should really be worried about. Let me give you another example. College junior at University of Mary Washington was a vocal leader in a campus group called Feminists United. She'd been outspoken about sexual violence and an incident involving rugby players. The comments sparked some 700 postings on Yik Yaks, including many calling for members of the group to be euthanized or tied to a radiator and raped. When the students asked the university to close down the site, the administration responded that the First Amendment prevented such actions because the campus received federal funds, and it suggested that the students contact the site. Well, that and a nickel. And after attending a demonstration to raise awareness about campus sexual assault, the group leader was murdered. Her alleged assailant is now facing trial, and Feminist United has filed a Title IX complaint against the university, claiming that it failed to protect them from sex discrimination and violence. In writing about this incident, Eugene acknowledged that the comments were vulgar and offensive, but that the federal government had no authority and no business requiring universities to shut down expression of such viewpoints. And that, I think, is where he and I disagree. And that's not an isolated example. I could give you countless others of people who facing bullying on cyberspace or on campus sites have simply withdrawn from public forum. When women started Red Rape Book, a project designed to tackle misogyny on Facebook, the founders were threatened with rape and death and bombarded with pornographic images. Yes, to be sure, they had, in theory, a legal remedy, but the result was instead that they retreated from chat rooms and gaming communities. They shut down blogs and websites, and they closed comments on blog posts. I think we who care about the First Amendment, as well as concerns about dignity and equality, need to do a lot better in thinking about how to deal with a cyber civil rights agenda, as well as the more traditional campus and workplace doctrine that we've been discussing. I think we need to think about expanding stalking and harassment laws to cover the kind of bias that I've noted, that give victims the right to sue under pseudonyms so that their lawsuits don't trigger more of the abuse that they've already experienced. The traditional justification for free expression, to encourage a marketplace of ideas, is undermined when harassment silences critics and pollutes the forums in which conversations need to occur. Cyber posts with nude photos, home addresses, and supposed interest in sex don't serve truth. They make victims unemployable and unable to exercise their First Amendment rights. And I think all of us in this room have a stake in figuring out how to do better. Thank you.
So do you think that we need to have a new civil rights doctrine of the internet?
Well, I've actually written a separate article about cyberbullying, which is sometimes dealt with, or quote, cyberbullying, close quote, which is sometimes dealt with under the rubric of harassment, but a different kind of harassment, so-called criminal harassment. And to me, always the question is, tell me what you mean by cyberbullying. And then you look at some of the statutes, it's like any speech, I'll give you an example actually of a statute that we're going to be challenging shortly, which bans any speech that is intended to abuse or harass online, period. That's it. Well, there's an exception for the media. In other situations, it's any speech that is intended to seriously emotionally distress. No, I don't think that's an acceptable basis for restricting speech. It wasn't in Hustler v. Falwell. It wasn't in Snyder v. Phelps. I don't think it would be as to cyberbullying. Now, again, if one defines it narrowly enough to ban threats, ban fighting words, ban unwanted messages again sent to a person or other unwanted posts about a person, I think that's permissible. Actually, certain kinds of speech, for example, so-called revenge porn, I think there are plausible arguments for restricting it. But again, to me, the important question is, what exactly is the proposed speech restriction? The speech restrictions of hostile environment harassment law, I think, are bad enough in the traditional context. I think that would be even worse if applied online. Bans on so-called cyberbullying, it all depends on how it's defined, but all the ones that I've seen define it in ways that I think are unconstitutionally overbroad. Now, if you have a particular proposal, I'm happy to talk about that language. But I urge everybody, when you hear about cyberbullying, ask, how are you defining cyberbullying? Because often the definitions are shockingly broad and vague.
Now, courts like mine have confronted these types of things, and sometimes courts deal with them by saying, well, if they're actual threats, that's when it rises, and you can draw a bright line often, and you can litigate on the margins on what a true threat is. But what's wrong with just keeping a true threat doctrine in place?
Well, I think back to the 1990s when anti-abortion groups circulated wanted posters picturing abortion providers who they claimed were guilty of crimes against humanity. And they provided names and addresses and recorded examples of violence against them. There was no direct threat there. But the Ninth Circuit, I think, rightly found that it constituted a threat because it was inferable from the consequences. The murder of doctors and the deterrence of others who stopped performing abortions because they feared for their lives. And I think we need to think about extending that kind of reasoning to at least some of what's going on under the rubric of cyberbullying. I actually, being a card-carrying member of the ACLU, am sympathetic to Eugene's point about overbroad statutes in this area. And certainly the ones he suggested would qualify. But I think we can and we must do better to come up with more narrowly tailored ways of curbing the kinds of expression that shuts down other expression, not furthers it.
Well, in our own profession, we've had some increased regulation of harassing speech and conduct in the ABA Model Rule 8.4. Is that a narrowly tailored way to address an issue in our profession?
So the answer is no, I think.
I thought you might say that.
Right. And I was trying to pull up the language of the proposed rule. So this is Rule 8.4, which does many things. But in relevant part, it essentially makes it a disciplinable offense for lawyers to engage in harassment, which is specifically mentioned as supposed to be borrowing the rules of employment law. Any actions related to the practice of law, including bar association and social functions. And harassment is, and unfortunately, for whatever reason, I can't seem to pull up the language, so I'm working from memory here. But harassment is defined as anything that expresses, is including things that express derogatory views based on race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, so on and so forth. So if the Federalist Society were to put on a CLE debate, hence related to the practice of law, a social or bar association type function, at which somebody who's a lawyer spoke out and said, I'm opposed to same-sex marriage because I think homosexuality is wrong and it's evil, and the court was wrong to fail to accept that. That's actually not at all my view, but if that person were to say it, under the proposed rule of 8.4, somebody might well file a complaint. And maybe the bar would find some way of dismissing that, but it seems to me that one could also say, no, this is indeed harassment because it is derogatory. Maybe if it is said often enough during the course of the conference, it might be seen as severe or pervasive, although it's not clear that Rule 8.4 even requires severity or pervasiveness. And after all, once you accept the notion that it's okay to expose these viewpoint-based restrictions on supposedly bad speech in the employment or educational public accommodation context, easy enough to then say, well, social and bar functions related to the practice of law. It could equally well be conversations over dinner at a law-related function. And this is deliberate on the part of the bar. They specifically say it extends to social and professional functions. Now, I actually support the notion of civility rules, certainly in the courtroom, where I would imagine there are many judges in the audience. I'm sure you enforce quite rigid civility rules, and rightly so, in the courtroom. I think it makes sense for the bar to require that when you're talking about interactions with opposing counsel in certain kinds of contexts, especially interactions with witnesses and the like. But this is deliberately an attempt to go beyond that. It is deliberately an attempt to suppress particular derogatory views in a wide range of conduct, expressly including social and professional activities. That is to say, social and bar association activities. I think that what they're getting is exactly what they're intending. They're intending to suppress particular views in these kinds of debates.
Do you have a response?
Well, to coin the cliche, the devil's in the details. And, I teach legal ethics, and from what I know about bar disciplinary agencies, they don't have enough resources to go after the people who steal from their clients' trust fund accounts. And the notion that they're going to start policing social conferences and go after people who make claims about their own views about the religious status of sexual orientation seems to me just wildly out of touch with the realities. Bar associations don't want to set off their members and go down those routes, and many people who are in bar disciplinary agencies care a lot about First Amendment values. So, someone might file a complaint, but, we can say that about pretty much anything in this country, right? That's not enough to deter us from taking appropriate actions. My own view on 8.4 was that it was a largely symbolic gesture. It doesn't get at much that you couldn't have gotten at other ways through employment laws, through curbs on civility and so forth. But I think the reason why proponents wanted it in the code was really as a matter of educating the next generation of lawyers, as well as a few practitioners in this one, about other values besides First Amendment expression. And, we as a profession, I think, have the capacity to deal with occasional abuses, and I'm just not sure that this rule is going to spark a lot of them. We're a profession that knows better than that, I would hope.
So that would depend upon a trust. We would be trusting that the organizations would not be going after people that they don't like, such as if people think that they don't like conservatives and that sort of thing. We would have to just trust them and rely
upon
them.
Well, and the courts. I never thought I would be saying this at a Federalist Society conference, but the rule of law, people, you know, it's still out there. I don't think we'd see a lot of toleration for those aberrant complaints.
Well, you know, we hear a lot about speech being chilled on the university campus today, and we've been talking about it. And I heard of something this week, and I wanted to get your take on it. I heard that students were staging walkouts on particular speakers, but then recording with their telephones all the people that were staying in the room, and then posting those students' pictures on a wall, a internet wall, you know, at their school, so that those people could be thought ill of, or perhaps they were to be congratulated and people wanted to get their notes later, but I don't think it was for that purpose. Do you think those are aberrations, anomalies? You're both on the campuses, I'm not. Does that have any bearing on this? Is that any type of harassment?
Well, it would trouble me if people were using those postings to punish those who went to hear viewpoints that aren't congenial to most of the campus. And, you know, there I think Eugene and I probably are in total agreement that the campuses need to be a forum for this. And I remember some examples of earlier in the fight against campus sexual assault, when women put graffiti on bathroom doors labeling their sexual offenders. You know, not a good thing, because those people had no forum in which to respond. But I think you also have to look at what was driving women to do that. And it was the fact that they felt like they didn't have a channel to be heard. And some of what I suspect drives people to out their fellow classmates is a feeling that their views aren't being respected. And so I think we just have to work really hard, especially at this historical moment, in creating campus environments where people can feel safe in expressing unpopular views.
Well, so this brings up this whole talk about silencing. And I resist the notion that speech can be restricted on the grounds that it silences others through the threat of public exposure, a threat of public condemnation or ridicule and the like. To be sure, speech that actually threatens violence should be punishable, whether it's intended to silence a speaker or anything else. But if somebody, for example, does decide to identify people who supposedly hold evil views because they showed up at this particular function, it seems to me that is their First Amendment right to do so. Let me give you an example of something that's not exactly the same but closely related. NAACP v. Claiborne Hardware. So there was a boycott of white-owned businesses by blacks in Claiborne County, Mississippi in the 1960s. Now, by the way, this boycott was aimed at deterring constitutionally protected behavior. There's no doubt that blacks shopping at white-owned stores, they had every constitutional right to do so. Yet the NAACP and various other groups tried to organize the boycott, and they enforced the boycott by stationing people. They didn't have cell phones then, but they stationed people outside of the stores. There were store watchers, and they would take down the name of all of the blacks who were shopping at the stores, and the names would be read in the black churches, which in my sense were very heavily attended then. There were also going to be mimeographs containing those lists of names. And there was a lawsuit based on that. And the Supreme Court unanimously said that was protected speech. even though it was in fact intended to deter constitutionally protected conduct. And even though there actually was some violence, not by the NAACP, but some people, and certainly foreseeable violence, against those who chose not to comply with the boycott. Now, I very much sympathize with people who felt intimidated, felt menaced by that, but I think but the Supreme Court said, look, this is constitutionally protected speech, and exposing people even to the risk, even ordinary average citizens, this wasn't even Jerry Falwell, ordinary average citizens to the risk of social ostracism for exercising their own constitutional rights, that is constitutionally protected. I think applying that logic, which is, I think, probably correct, but in any event, it is the law and has been since 1982. It's pretty shocking. This is a late 1960s case, and the decision is a 1982 decision. It tells us something that most of us already know about the civil justice system. But in any event, I think that logic means that the fact that somebody is silencing speakers or actors engaged in constitutionally protected conduct through the threat of social ostracism, that's protected. And of course, this happens all the time, right? There are probably lots of people who are reluctant to express views for fear of being derided as racists or having calls to have them fired and so on and so forth. And I can condemn such mislabeling like that. I can condemn such calls, but I wouldn't say that there ought to be a law prohibiting people from trying to silence speech by threatening boycotts and the like. Likewise, there shouldn't be similar restrictions aimed at preventing silencing speech in these contexts.
Well, I agree as a matter of First Amendment doctrine, and I agree with that decision. I was speaking more as a policy matter about what we need to do to create campus climates where that doesn't happen, because it does shut down debate. And I do think we should get the audience involved here. And we've been talking at each other for a long time, so maybe others want to join the debate.
Does anyone wish to ask a question? You're the first hand I see.
Professor Rota, you seem to concede that these harassment laws do deter a substantial amount of speech, both directly through the types of conduct that is prohibited, and even the cases that went too broad, you admitted, casted a long shadow. So the bottom line seems to be this does restrict speech, it does suppress speech, but this is a sufficiently compelling problem that I think the First Amendment should allow us to suppress speech to address it. And I guess, is it correct that that's the bottom line? And what other areas should we start applying that to? I mean, how is that any different than Nazis wanting to have a parade? That seems like it would, be extremely distressing to everyone. What other areas are we willing to suppress speech because we've decided something is sufficiently compelling?
Well, I gave the kind of examples in my talk where I think we need to protect workplaces in which people are able to perform effectively, irrespective of race and gender, and campuses where there's an interest in providing an environment where people's opportunities to get an education aren't impaired. I certainly would defend the right of Nazis to walk in Skokie. It was, one of the things that caused me to write the first check to the ACLU. I think we desperately need protection of unpopular speech. So I think there are ways to cabin the doctrine. But we also have to recognize that certain kinds of speech is, as the court has recognized, of low value. And, suck my dick, you black bitch, is not advancing public discussion of important social issues. And I think we can and should make those distinctions.
I appreciate the argument, and I do think that indeed some distinctions should be drawn. For example, some such speech, possibly including that, may be fighting words, some of it may be threats. You could even imagine hostile environment harassment law have been developed that says, epithets or personal insults are actionable, but other kinds of speech is not. But that's not a line that hostile environment harassment law draws. There is no case that I know of that says, well, we're going to limit harassment law in this way. And that's why employers don't advise why lawyers don't advise their clients. Oh, well, it's okay if it's political advocacy, just not if it's this low-value speech, because that's not a line the law draws. If the law had drawn that line, we would be having a different debate, or perhaps no debate at all. So yes, there are problems out there, and there are tools available, whether under existing exceptions or possibly you can imagine arguments for other exceptions. I just think this is a bad tool.
What do you say about a hypothetical where a company says, I don't want any racist or sexist or homophobic speech, and therefore I don't want anyone to advocate for X political candidate in our office space because I believe they are racist, sexist, homophobic. And you will be fired if you were advocating for that candidate because they're racist, sexist, and homophobic.
Well,
but they haven't banned all political advocacy, mm-hmm. which I think we all agree a private employer could ban.
Yeah.
Is that, or y'all,
yeah.
do you? So if they haven't, but they've only limited to candidates that they deem racist, sexist, and homophobic.
Well, I'm a big believer in the state action doctrine. The First Amendment does not apply to private employers' own decisions. I think they're going to be constrained in some measure by the market. They're also going to be constrained by state law. So many states ban employers from limiting their employees' political activity, and that's defined at varying levels of breadth in different states. Off the job, many of those statutes also apply potentially to on-the-job speech. DC bans, as I mentioned, political affiliation discrimination, and without any limitation to off-the-job. So it may be one could argue that speech or bans on advocacy of one candidate but not another would therefore be illegal under state law. But I don't think it's a First Amendment problem. My concern is when employment law puts people in a position where they feel the pressure from the risk of governmental retaliation to impose these kinds of restrictions. And one of the things that so struck me about the Gadsden flag case is, I certainly can understand that some people might take certain messages that are on their face, racially or religiously or sexually neutral, and interpret them as hostile towards their groups. Certainly, I could understand somebody saying, for example, well, when I hear somebody saying, vote for Trump or make America great again, I'm going to perceive that as expressing hostility to Muslims, let's say, or based on some of the president-elect statements in the campaign, hostility Hispanics. So one could certainly imagine that. But if employers are put in a position where they have to suppress that kind of speech, not because of their own choice, which is wise or not and legal or not under state law, but because of the fear that a government agency will say, well, look, in context, this Make America Great statement might be seen as racially or religiously offensive, and if said pervasively enough, could create a hostile environment and expose you to hundreds of thousands of dollars in liability, that I think would be a really serious problem.
Well, just the point I made earlier, I mean, the history of enforcement of Title VII and Title IX is under enforcement, not over enforcement. Very few people make complaints, and the notion that employers are going to be so worried about the small fraction of people who would come forward with a complaint that couldn't possibly win under First Amendment grounds seems to me not as compelling as some of the problems of unregulated harassing speech that I've mentioned.
Okay, we'll take one more question. Yes, sir. You. Yes.
Shout it out. Professor Roney, for some of your more graphic examples of the workplace harassment, you talked about libel law may not be helpful here. How about the tort of intentional or negligent infliction of emotional distress, which is recognized in all the jurisdictions and includes punitive damages, handle some of those kind of examples?
Yeah. Well, in theory, yes, but in practice, you don't see those cases. I mean, there's no money in it. What are the damages for somebody? What lawyer's going to take that case on a contingency basis? So yes, you know, some of the conduct I mentioned might qualify, but I don't think it's a practical way to police abuse in the workplace or on the campus.
I would say that if one is concerned about free speech in this situation, one should be very concerned about that tort. I don't like the tort at all as rule of law principles, even applied to non-speech conduct. But when applied to speech, it seems to me that's even more clearly a vague and overbroad restriction on speech. The court has already in Snyder v. Phelps held that as to speech in matters of public concern, the emotional distress tort can't apply. I would argue this more broadly as well. Whatever the rules are for restricting speech, a standard that says speech can be restricted because it is outrageous and recklessly inflicts severe emotional distress, that is not a standard that is acceptable, I think, under the First Amendment.
Well, I think our time is drawing to a close, but we need to give thanks to our lovely.
Thank you. Thank you very much.